I think we've had over 700 people, when you add video and audio, listen to the first lecture of this course. And it gets lower to go down, but that's because it takes time for people. So we'll probably have a few thousand people within a few years listening to this. So that's, we're watching it online and stuff, so that's really encouraging. Okay, so let's talk about evolution. A lot of the information that I'm going to be discussing in the case for creation, okay, is going to come from Norman Geisler and J. Kirby Anderson's work called Origin Science. I think it's a phenomenal book. Now, they're old Earth creationists. I'm a young Earth creationist. But I think their argumentation is still strong. And J. Kirby Anderson, by the way, one of the nicest guys on the planet Earth. I don't know if anybody here, I don't even know the name of his radio show, but he's got a radio show with like 250,000 listeners and stuff, and he's a really great guy. He's based out of Texas. I'll probably see him in March when I go there for a meeting of the International Society of Christian Apologetics. But one of the first things they point out in their book, Geisler and Anderson, or in their work, Origin Science, is that the founders of modern science themselves were Bible-believing Christians. Okay, so you get Galileo, Isaac Newton, Francis Bacon, Johannes Kepler, Blaise Pascal. So the founders of virtually all the branches of modern science were Bible-believing Christians. So this idea that you cannot be a Christian and a good scientist is just plain bogus. Also, there's a reason why the founders of modern science were Christians. And that was because even when the ancient Greeks did science, there was always the possibility that the senses were deceiving them. I mean, they even had to invent the Logos doctrine, that the Logos is out there, some rational mind that brings order to the changing world, the world of flux, the world of the senses, and the Logos enlightens our minds to understand this world. So a kind of non-personal mind. Now, that didn't make a lot of sense. But when the Apostle John came on the scene, he basically said, you know what the Greeks call the Logos? Exists. And the Logos does enlighten the minds of every man. But the Logos is not a non-personal force. And so he said, in the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. So we translated, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. But Christianity believed that a rational God created us in His image so that we're rational beings, and created the world in a way that makes sense, so that through reason, man can find truth in the world, and science makes sense. So this was the foundation for modern science, was belief in a rational God. So science was built upon that belief. Even issues like Galileo, we always make Galileo that was the church versus science. No. All the scientists worked at the universities, and all the universities were Christian universities. So the debate was between Christian scientists who wanted to stay with Aristotelian physics and believe that the earth was the center of the universe and the sun revolved around the earth, and those who wanted to go in the direction of Galileo and where the evidence was starting to point, and that is that the earth revolves around the sun, not the other way around. So it was actually an intramural debate between Christians, those who wanted to, and don't forget Thomas Aquinas took Aristotelian thought, Aristotle's metaphysics, his philosophy, and his physics and his science, and blended that with biblical Christianity. So now for, you know, 300 years, the church has been using Aristotle's scientific views of a geocentric world, and so a lot of the churchmen weren't ready to give up on it. So the lesson people tell us, you know, you go to a secular college and they'll tell you, from Galileo, we learned that the church should submit to science and accept the new scientific theories. No, the lesson is the exact opposite. The church should be very tentative about accepting the latest scientific theories, because when those theories, like Aristotle's geocentric universe, when they get proven false, if we've so closely aligned ourselves to it, it makes the church look bad. It makes Christianity look bad. That's the same with Christianity and politics. We have to be very careful. We need to be active in politics. We need to be very careful that we not align ourselves to a party so that we start baptizing all their sins and saying, yeah, well, this, you don't understand this and that, and blah, blah, blah. Changing our interpretation of the Bible to fit political theory. And so whatever the case, but Galileo was a... Galileo science side, by the way, used as many verses pulled out of context to defend his view as the other side pulled verses out of context to defend their view. Okay? And the only reason why he was under house arrest, because he was a jerk. Every time when the Pope told him, shut up, he said, no, and you're an idiot. You know, so he's constantly just kept doing it. Finally said, all right, look, put him under house arrest. He can't leave that, and we'll feed him real well. He's an important guy. We'll treat him real good, but he can't leave. He's going to badmouth me like this. He can't leave. And so that's often misrepresented, but Galileo himself was a biblical Christian. Now, let me say this about creation or evolution. Neither creation nor evolution, scientifically speaking, is a scientific theory. Because for it to be a scientific theory, you have to use the scientific method. The scientific method, by the way, is so inappropriately named, because it's not the only method in science. The scientific method, you know, you start out with observation, you know, and you find a problem, you propose a solution, you come up with a hypothesis, you test the hypothesis, and then if the hypothesis seems to pass those tests, you come up with a theory. Okay? Well, evolution and creation, neither one of them could be observed. We can't just say, okay, well, let's just sit down and, oh, something new is being created, or something new is evolving out of something else. You know, both sides admit you cannot observe this. Okay? Evolution, supposedly it occurs too slowly. Creation, God did it. Whether you think it was thousands of years ago like me, or billions of years ago like Geisler and Kirby Anderson, God's not doing it anymore. He he sees from this creation work. So for evolution, so it's number one, it's not a fact. Even C.S. Lewis referred to biological evolution as a fact in one of his writings. It's not a fact, but it's not even a theory. In reality, it's just a scientific model. In other words, it's not where the evidence of observation points. It's a way creationism and evolutionism, they're just different ways to interpret the evidence. Okay? It's like, you know, well, common anatomy, there's evidence for evolution. No, it isn't. Common anatomy, the arm of a man, the arm of a gorilla, the wing of a bird, the fin of a shark. Common anatomy doesn't have to prove common ancestry. It could prove common design. Okay? So there's just different ways to interpret the evidence. The way evolutionists talk, you would think it was fact, or at least theory, but in reality, it's just a different model, a different way to explain the data. And so you can ask which model is more plausible. So they're both models, different ways to interpret the evidence, but it's based on circumstantial evidence. Okay? So what we're dealing with, and we ask which model is more plausible. So what we're dealing with, this is forensic science. Did O.J. kill his ex-wife and her friend? Well, you don't use operation science. Operation science uses the scientific method, and it uses observation because you're dealing with repeatable processes that are currently going on, okay? But the founders of modern science also realized there's origin science, which deals with non-repeatable singular events of the past. Now, you'll have a lot of evolutionists, not the smartest cookies out there, a lot of evolutionists that will say, wow, if you're dealing with non-repeatable singular events of the past, and it's not present processes, then that's not science. And then 2 minutes later, the guy tells you he believes in the Big Bang. Excuse me, a singular event in the past. Okay? Now, he's looking at the expansion of the universe and then reasoning back to the Big Bang. Okay? But it's still a non-repeatable singular event in the past. And by the way, there are other ways to explain what appears to be the expansion of the universe. So I'm not convinced of the Big Bang myself. But most scientists do hold the Big Bang cosmology. But when you have a scientific model, you deal with origin science, you don't deal with a scientific method. Instead, you use the principles of causality, an analogy, and you look at the circumstantial evidence. Okay. Causality, every effect must have an adequate cause. Okay? You walk in a room, there's a guy laying down with a knife in his back, you don't think, oh, that's interesting, and then just walk away. I mean, there's got to be an adequate cause, a sufficient cause for that effect. Every effect must have an adequate cause. Analogy, similar effects usually have similar causes. Okay? So you find that certain entities on a submolecular level have the complexity of spaceships or computers, it's safe to say that since spaceships and computers took intelligent design, that those entities were probably intelligently designed as well. So you use these principles and you deal with circumstantial evidence to try to explain the non-repeatable singular events of the past. No one witnessed creation occurring, except for God, and then portions of it, the angels. And no one witnessed the supposed evolutionary changes in the past. So, what we need to look at is the beginning of the universe, or the origin of the universe. So for origin science, you got the origin of the universe, the origin of first life, and the origin of complex life. Okay? So three different areas that we can ask, which model is more plausible? Now with the beginning of the universe, Big Bang proponents would argue that, you know, as you move forward in time, the universe is expanding all different directions. As you move backwards in time, the universe gets more and more dense till eventually you reach a point of infinite density, basically a point where the universe just no longer existed. Okay? So the universe had a beginning. Even if you don't hold to the Big Bang model, the second law of thermodynamics, energy deterioration or entropy, would also show that the universe had a beginning. Because the amount of usable energy we're running out of, so that if you go backwards in time, eventually you reach the point where all the energy in the universe was in a usable state, that would mark the beginning of the universe. So either way you look at it, the universe had a beginning, and whatever had a beginning needs a cause. If the universe had a beginning, it's more plausible that God created the universe rather than the universe just popped into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause. By the way, the cause of all nature, by definition, must transcend nature, so by definition must be supernatural. Okay? And so therefore the creation model is more plausible. When you look at the origin of first life, you find that a single-celled animal contains enough genetic information to fill 20,000 volumes of encyclopedia. Only intelligence can cause this amount of information. Norman Geisler, talking about specified complexity, he says in this book that if you look at the Grand Canyon, you could come up with a non-intelligent natural laws to explain how it came about. Even that's a debate, by the way. But when you see the faces on Mount Rushmore, that took intelligent intervention, intelligent design to bring that about. So, this amount of intelligence can only be caused by intelligent design. So again, to bring life from non-life, the creation model is more plausible. By the way, in my college evolutionary biology textbook, it told me that the cell theory said that the most basic unit of life is the cell, and all cells came from pre-existing cells. And then it states, this of course does not apply to the first cell, which had to have evolved from non-living material. So they tell me what they prove, and then they just throw in an assumption with absolutely no proof. So it's like the cell theory means all cells came from pre-existing cells. It's life from life, and that's just the way it is. Of course, this didn't apply to the first cell, which had to have evolved from non-living material. No proof for it whatsoever. It was just assumed in the textbook. Well, the creation model is more plausible. The amount, the increase in the amount of highly complex information called specified complexity, that takes intelligent intervention. And then the origin of new, more complex life forms. Well, when you look at the fossil record, new life forms appear suddenly and fully developed. Okay? And by the way, if things aren't fully developed, they're not going to function. I mean, if you had arms evolving into wings, or wings evolving into arms, you know, you're not going to be able to fly or pick up things, okay? And but in the fossil record, new life forms appear suddenly and fully developed. There's gaps in the fossil record. There's absolutely no evidence for missing links for transitional forms. There's so the evidence of missing links in the fossil record is so non-existent that it's caused many evolutionists to move into Stephen Jay Gould's camp called punctuated equilibrium, which is the idea that everything remains the same. You know, apes look like apes, and then all of a sudden over 20,000 to 100,000 years, so quickly that nothing gets fossilized, you have a transitional form, and then it gives way to something else. So, you know, you'll see that, you know, it's an exaggeration to say that two apes got together and had a baby boy, and enough baby boys and baby girls were born at approximately the same time to apes, to where you'll have the apes, you'll have the humans, no transitional forms. In reality, the punctuated equilibrium will say, yeah, there's a 20,000 to 100,000 year window where the transitional forms existed, but they didn't exist long enough to be fossilized. So it used to be, we used to look at the fossil record and say the transitional forms are proof for evolution. Now, even Darwin admitted that there weren't hardly any. So, but he said, but given enough time, they're gonna prove me right. Well, it's been, you know, like 150 years since Darwin, and there's even less accepted transitional forms than there was before. I mean, Archaeopteryx supposedly between reptiles and birds, and when it's now classified as a bird, and we also know birds were already around before it, and it was supposed to be the predecessor of them. So, but now they're looking and saying, well, yeah, no, the fossil record supports evolution, even though there's no evidence, no fossils of missing links. I mean, that's like saying the lack of evidence from my view is some of the best evidence from my view that there is.
Well, it's the same thing in some of the textbooks. You judge the fossil records by the strata you're found, but then you judge the strata, or you time the strata by the fossils you find.
Yeah, you talk about you date. A lot of times you'll date the fossils. They act like they're so they can figure out exactly how old. You date the fossils by, okay, well, we got to, when we carbon 14 dated, we're getting numbers all over the place. Well, they got to be within the numbers of this strata. And the strata we know is X amount of years old. Well, how do you know that? Well, based on the fossils that we found in. So just circular reasoning there.
But this punctuated equilibrium, it sounds even less tenable than that, because it sounds like what they're doing with that is they're saying the lack of evidence that we have, in the fact that we don't have any fossils, proves that our point. How is that any different from what they accuse Christians of when they say?
Oh, yeah, big time. Big time. And, you know, you're exactly right there. And this is a big problem for, there's so many people that went into the punctuated equilibrium camp, so that, was it Colin Patterson of the British Museum, Stephen Jay Gould of the American Museum, and Patterson's response to Stephen Jay Gould is, I don't have a good, you know, argument against your views, because we just do not have fossils of transitional forms. So, you know, the leading proponent of the gradual school, which is really what Darwinism is supposed to be. Evolution means gradual change. They acknowledge that the punctuated equilibrium guys are correct. There are no fossils of transitional forms. Now, they should also be honest and say, therefore, that the creationists are correct, because there's no fossils of transitional forms. I think it's also very convenient that you have all these transitional forms just happen to be in very quick periods of time, so no fossilization occurred. I myself think that the fossil record was caused by the global flood. It's evidence of a global catastrophe. It's not the the history of life on the planet Earth. Examples of that would be like polystrate fossils.
Yeah.
So you'll have different layers that supposedly take millions of years to form, and yet you got, you know, one tree running through several of them. Nobody's going to claim the tree is millions of years old. Okay?
Or you see a miner's cap that was fossilized.
Yeah, yeah, but now the craziest thing is we're finding elastic, soft tissue in T-Rex bones and a Triceratops horn. And the evolutionists used to say, and I think they were correct, that soft tissue cannot exist for millions of years. Now, instead of saying, well, therefore, then these dinosaur bones are only thousands of years old, they're now saying, I guess soft tissue can exist for millions of years. So,
that was easy.
By the way, as they're saying, I guess it can, there's an awful lot of these people, scientists, that are losing their jobs for writing papers on finding it. And it was all because of the box was too small to put the T-Rex femur bone in. So the lady scientist that I saw in half, she has been dragged through the mud. And she's an atheistic evolutionist. But you're not supposed to report all the facts if they don't fit with the dominant worldview. Also, the human brain contains enough information to fill 20 million volumes of encyclopedia. You can't get that amount of information from a single cell by chance. Mutations only garble the already existing genetic code, so those who argue for mutations, if you got like 26 letters in the English alphabet, a mutation might scramble the order or it might drop a few letters, but it's not going to add any new information. Now, the loss of information might be temporarily beneficial, but that's very temporary. And, like, for instance, if there was a genetic defect mutation in a moth, so it no longer stuck to walls, and if the easiest way to kill them was on the walls, he might outlive his buddies, but eventually, you know, he's going to get stepped on by something anyway. But mutations only garble the already existing genetic code. No new information is added. So even a theologian like Charles Ryrie used to ask, where did a single-celled animal get the genetic information for teeth or hair color? Because according to the evolutionists, we came from that. The conclusion for the case of for creation, the origin of the universe, first life and complex life forms show the creation model to be more plausible than the evolution model, okay? And so we'll look at the scientific case against evolution, the unproven assumptions, and then if I remember to make copies of my PowerPoint presentation on Jonathan Wells' Icons of Evolution, we'll talk about some of his contributions as well. So, all right, God bless you, everyone.